Hello, and welcome to Music Maps, the Rock and Roll Book Club podcast. In each episode, we'll use a place as a jumping-off point for a conversation about music, anywhere from the obvious to the obscure. So, welcome. We're at part two of our wonderful conversation with Mickey Bereny of Lush and Peroshka. We're picking up where we left off in episode one. Strap yourself in. We're going on a ride. This is Music Maps. Here we go. I'm hanging out in Camden, drinking with my girlfriends on a Saturday night. The sky says, come and meet my girlfriend. She's sitting in the corner looking rather uptight. So I say hello. So you haven't been going very long, but pretty soon obviously get the interest of 4AD and they sign you. Who signed you to 4AD? Was that Ivo? Or?
Yeah. So he came to see us play with the Pale Saints.
Yeah.
And I think it was probably only about a year after we actually played our first gig. So I think Meriel left in like the kind of November of that year. And then I'd barely been the singer for very long at all. It was a matter of months.
Yeah.
And then 4AD came to see us. We were fucking awful, by the way. We were appalling live. It was a shambles. But because we got quite a lot of press attention.
Yeah.
Not least because Emma knew a lot of press people from working with Jeff.
With Jeff, yeah. He knows
but also,
everyone.
You know, I would stand by the fact that a lot of those writers had come out of the fanzine scene. So, you know, we did know like John Robb and James Brown and yeah. Everett True and all of these people had come out of, we knew them from when we were writing fanzines. And, you know, a lot of them wrote about each other's bands and there also was a lot of competition. Don't forget, Sounds existed then as well.
Yeah.
So you had these weekly papers that were coming out. They were constantly looking for bands to review and there was a real, you know, like bands would get reviewed like really early on. The difference is that most bands were a little bit wiser and made sure that they were actually well rehearsed and fit to play before they fucking put themselves out there, which we didn't, right? We were like, oh, we'll just learn it as we go along. And that meant that we were already getting reviewed and we were already getting like coverage. And so we already had like major labels kind of showing interest.
Yeah.
But basically we ended up with both Rough Trade and 4AD interested. And for 4AD, I mean, not least because Howard Gough, who was the plugger at 4AD, who, you know, described us as the worst band he'd ever seen in his life and really didn't want Ivo to sign
That's
us.
That's the man you want to go into Radio 1 for, you, isn't it?
I know. And because, you know, 4AD were an independent label and they had a very much a kind of family dynamic within, you know, the staff, you know, everybody had to be on board if they were going to sign a band. So, you know, in a kind of act of caution, he put us in the studio with John Fryer to record demos and then everybody did like the demos. So then we recorded another three and then that became Scar, which was the first like mini album that we put out.
And you're out touring. I mean, you do gigs with My Bloody Valentine. You say you're part of that same scene that they're on and the Darling Buds. How many gigs were you doing? I mean, were you busy?
Yeah, we were really
studio,
busy.
Studio, touring.
We were very, very, very busy, you know, not least because we were also trying to write songs and, you know, and because we did it that way, because we recorded six songs for a mini album, we then, you know, that was most of our set. And then we had to write more songs. And then that got a four-track EP. And then we wrote more songs. And then that was another four-track EP. And it was like, you know, like touring, playing, writing, recording. It was just an absolute constant.
You did a Peel session. Was this important to you? Because for some bands, that was as far as they'd want to go, wasn't it? You know, sitting in a pub, oh, wouldn't it be great if we were on John Peel? And they would never think beyond that. Was that, again, still an accolade and something like
your business? Oh, it was a massive deal for us, yeah.
So why did you go in and do Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep?
It wasn't, no, we did Hey Hey Helen.
Right.
Yeah, because that was in our set. And don't forget, you know,
I'm only joking, of course, about this. I mean, the beauty of a John Peel session is you could experiment, couldn't you? You're going to play.
Yeah, but we were very, like I say, we weren't slick or professional. all those early recordings, I was so nervous. So the idea of going into a Peel session where you're effectively recording with, you know, not your team.
The like guy from Mott the Hoople,
exactly,
the drummer.
A bunch of people who expect you to go in and be like a kind of, you know, well-rehearsed, cohesive band. Which,
because you don't have much time, do you? It's bang, bang, but you're in there for a day.
Yeah, it's four tracks in a day, you know what I mean? But I think it went fine. Robin Guthrie actually came with us. He was kind of like, you know, backseat driving the whole time. So that
he
was...
produces the two EPs that precede the album.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He did Mad Love and Black Spring. So,
how did he come into it?
I think Emma had sent him demos even before we signed 4AD. Mm. So he was already interested. And then we did those EPs. But when it came to recording the album, I think he really wanted to record the album. I think Ivo was very reluctant. And it was, you know, partly because there was all sorts of... It was around the time the Cocteaus were kind of... were falling out with 4AD and, you know, eventually left not long after. So there was quite a lot of politics behind all of that. But, the Peel session was... I really enjoyed it. But, you know, the thing with John Peel was that, you know, he had his... kind of favourite bands. I mean, he was he was nice enough about us, but we never got asked back and he wasn't a particular fan of ours. So, you know.
Well, that's a shame. But I say, it wasn't the peak of what you've achieved. So we can skate over that. So just before you release your album, you lose your bassist, Steve Rippon. So what happened there?
Well, I mean, to be fair to Steve, so really the thing is that when we all formed that band, we were all at North London Poly. I think it was seen as quite a casual thing, you know what I mean? It was like, yeah, I'll join a band. I think the workload like really did kind of overwhelm Steve. Like, I just don't think he realised what he was getting himself into. Mm. He was a little bit older than us, so we were all on the same course, but he was a mature student. I mean, Meriel was as well. And, you know, he had a proper relationship. He was going out with Irene. They'd been together for years. She was a teacher. You know, she had a proper fucking job. And, you know, I think the band was a great, like, he loved bands and he loved music. He's incredibly knowledgeable about music. And I think he got to the end of that year and just thought, do you know what? I've kind of done it. I've done everything I wanted to do. I've been in the NME and the Melody Maker. I've gone on tour. I've played in America. I've played in Japan. I've recorded an album. I've kind of done everything. And all I can see now is it's just going to go downhill for me. And not least because it's actually a very precarious lifestyle. Yeah. It was quite hard for him that, you know, if Irene would have her school holidays, we were on tour.
Yeah, there are some people who are not suited to that.
And it just didn't really fit.
He was also listening to the cricket commentary during rehearsals, which I can really relate to. So he was listening to Test Match Special, Mark, while they were supposed to be rehearsed.
I don't know what to say to that. I mean, we have, yeah.
I've done this myself, not during a rehearsal, but I have listened to England cricket while I've been working on a headphone many times.
Yeah, to be fair, it was just one earpiece plugged into a transistor
radio. That's exactly what I do. You put it on the side that no one see you from.
Yeah.
No one will realise, apart from when something happens and you react to it and then everyone knows.
And I think also, you know, part of the reason why Meriel got kind of, you know, kicked out the band and part of, you know, Steve leaving is that I do think there's a point where you do have to kind of give up a lot to be in a band, right? All of your time and all of your energy.
And there's no money at the beginning at all.
There's no money. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't really work if you don't have that level of commitment from everyone involved. And, you know, fair play to Steve. You know, he preempted that. He said, look, I'm just not going to be able to do it. And especially because, you know, I mean, he's got a proper job now, you know what I mean? And they had a family and that would have been impossible to do with the chaos that was Lush. So
So Phil King comes in to replace.
Mm.
And then the debut album comes out, early weeks of 1992, and it gets to number 7 in the charts. Were you expecting it to chart so high or was that a surprise?
What do I think? Do you know what? I so don't give a fuck about charts.
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck about charts. I don't give a fuck about awards, probably because I never win any or stand a chance in any of those kind of leagues. So I can't actually remember if that was like a big deal.
That sounds like a big deal for me, because this is still the age where, you know, the enemy's produced in the indie charts. You know that. And you'll be top of the indie charts. But the charts, seven is really, really decent.
I'm not poo-pooing it. I mean, we were delighted. But I don't think it was like, oh, that's nice. I mean, you know, I just think it's not like
it feels a bit higher than some of the other bands from this scene were probably getting at the time, is my guess.
I mean, I just think that I can hand on heart say that I just didn't really care. It is nice to have some validation.
Yeah.
But that's more for other people.
Sure, yeah.
And I just think that, you know, I remember at the time certain bands, and I'm not going to mention them, but, you know, off that scene, kind of getting chart positions and really kind of going on and on about it in interviews. Yeah, that proves that we're somebodies. And I just thought, well, it doesn't, though. It's fucking meaningless. It's down to your record label and how, you know, whether some DJ fucking decided that he thought it would be a cool record to play. There's so many arbitrary things around that, right?
I think I've been reading, and I'm not going to pick on Creation, but I think when the stakes are, when bands, you know, the record label is spending a load of money on bands. I'm not mentioning My Bloody Valentine for it, or you know, the House of Love, but you know, they're running up a big studio bill, and really to recoup, the label, this that reads needs to be a success, and then somehow it stalls at 41. Those kind of stories I'm kind of familiar. So I think that's a massive triumph. But this part of the story, you know, whether you deem it a success or not, but you know, you following this, you know, Lush get some big success in America. You end up doing the Lollapalooza tour, which again seems a little bit odd at first. So how did that come about? Wouldn't necessarily have thought of you as a natural fit with all the Chili Peppers and Pearl Jam, but you get that gig.
Neither was the Mary Chain.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, don't forget that that festival was set up by Perry Farrell.
Yeah.
So it's quite eclectic and down to his tastes as well. And I think that, you know, at that time,
was it Perry who chooses the bands, or was it by Live Nation or whatever they were then?
I think that there were people involved. You know, I'll tell you what, I am not the most reliable person to ask. I do tend to downplay things only because they're just not that important to me.
Yeah.
Like, I am not the person who's going to go, well, obviously Perry was like a massive fan of Lush and he thought we'd be amazing on this tour. I just can't actually bring myself to sort of talk shit like that, because first of all, I don't know if it's true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just think, well, I don't know. So I do give a lot of credit to Howard. He was a fucking nightmare often as a manager, but he absolutely, as far as he possibly could, to ingratiate himself with all of those people on that scene, or, you know, whether it was Live Nation or the agents or the organisers.
So this is Howard Goff, your original manager?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The one who said we were the worst band in London, who was the plugger. He ended up becoming our manager. And I know, right? And and basically, you know, I think, I just think there's always a huge amount of luck involved with these things. You know, 4AD had just signed a licensing deal with Warner Brothers. So, you know, they were very much on side, wanting to promote all of the 4AD acts. It worked for them. So I don't know how much muscle they had involved with getting one of these 4AD bands on Lollapalooza. There's all sorts of behind the scenes stuff that probably went on. I mean, we went on that tour. I was fucking terrified. I remember sort of getting sent like videos and tapes of all the different bands and just head in hands thinking, like actually almost feeling physically ill, just thinking, this is 9 weeks. This is going to be like this American rock crowd. It's going to be like, what am I going to do if it's just, I don't know if emotionally I can take it, if these people are just real, you know, American macho. Like, I just don't know. I'm going to be such a fish out of water. But actually, it was brilliant.
Right.
And I do think that, to my point being that, you know, it is an unusual bill, but I do think alternative, inverted commas, music at the time you have to immerse it in that time. Like, yes, yeah. If you think Chili Peppers, Ministry, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, right, that does connote quite a different thing now, right? At that time, in America as well, alternative music was just this, it was college music. It was this morass of anything that wasn't mainstream was in
and
that
also,
bucket.
And also, one thing in America that I've noticed is that a lot of people are happy just to watch a band. And they're not as snooty as in England where they're like, oh, you know, I like shoegaze or I like this. I'm a metal fan.
Yeah, it
a lot
wasn't
of Americans,
quite as tribal.
A lot of Americans don't have that tribal.
No, and you did have a lot of people who were quite Anglophile.
Right.
Like there was a thing
so
about...
So they were probably reading NME on input and they knew who you were. And
they wouldn't really differentiate between, right, say, yeah, the Stone Roses, yeah, and Swerve Driver or something. Do you know what I mean? To them, oh, it's all British. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. Which is quite liberating, really.
So were there any other bands on this tour that you got on with or bonded with?
We got on very well with Ministry and all of their crew because collectively there must have been about 40 people involved with Ministry. Like they were, I mean, all of them, to be honest, I did talk to pretty much everybody there. I mean, there were bands that we hung around with more. We did hang around quite a lot with the Mary Chain. You know, especially like the other members in their band, again, a lot of their crew. You know, this was a time when bands, crew, yeah, everyone was all wodged together. There was no VIP area or people turning up in their separate helicopters. It was just one big, you know, if you were staying overnight somewhere, everyone was in the same hotel. It was, you know, chaos at the bar and it was really good fun.
Did you watch that documentary about Woodstock 99?
Yeah. I was just thinking about this.
I mean, you know, it is about how the festival was a disaster and there was shit everywhere and there was no drinking water.
One of the most insane things I've ever seen.
But I'm struck. I can't remember the band. I remember Kid Rock coming on in the most immaculate, massive white fur coat and there's like mud and shit everywhere. But then what struck me, though, was the mosh pit. It wasn't a mosh pit. It was the entirety of the arena, just up and down. It was incredible to watch.
I mean, it was, but I think by then, see, what's interesting, when I watched that, I remember thinking, this is where that kind of Lollapalooza thing, you could see the foothills of it. I remember the kind of digging up the turf and wrecking the kind of, you know, like the kind of chaos of that audience, you know, especially when a band like Pearl Jam were on or Ministry.
Yeah.
But where it ended up was intolerant jocks who only want to hear one kind of music. And if you're not playing that kind of... Like if Lush had played at Woodstock 99,
oh, you'd have been
we would have
bottled,
been
yeah,
covered in bottles of piss and stuff. Do you know what I mean? And that's the sort of ugly end of it. Because alternative, however much you want to ridicule it as a title, one of the prerequisites was that you fucking like music. By the time you get to Woodstock 99, it's just jocks who want to drink beer,
yeah,
and have a fucking Barney, right? It doesn't actually matter what's on that stage as long as it fits their kind of macho credentials. And that's not what alternative music was.
Now, you've mentioned in the book that all of that stuff you have to do, you know, to become massive in America. Faced with that, what do you think might have happened if Lush had become as big as Pearl Jam or whatever?
It's so difficult for me to think that because it would never have happened. It just was never going to happen. You know, me and Emma and the rest of us could have told them all that.
Yeah.
So we played the game, you know, we believed them. They were like, oh no, you're on the brink of this. And you think, okay, fine, we'll do it. You know, I love touring. I'm very happy to do a billion interviews. It really doesn't bother me. It's like, to me, it was all kind of good fun.
Yeah.
But I could, you know, that's not, and probably, okay, let's just hypothetically say, if we'd have done, you know, had some massive hit with fucking, you know, Desire Lines or something, as unlikely as that is, right?
Hey, TikTok, you never know.
Well, no, I mean, I get that retrospectively, yeah, but as a kind of living, breathing band.
Yes.
Well, what would have happened is they... You know, we would have had like Howard as the manager going, right, now you've got to follow it up and you've got to write something similar.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
we were never like that. I mean, you know, for all of the, you know, difficulties that me and Emma have had in terms of our personal relationship, we were pretty on board together with the music. we didn't really copy the zeitgeist. I know lots of people said, oh, you copied, you kind of jumped on board the Britpop thing. And of course there's an influence. Like you think, all right, let's make a record where the vocals are more upfront or blah, blah, blah. But the songs really weren't that different because we always wrote songs that were, you know, sort of more introverted or contemplative, but we also wrote quite poppy songs and, you know, like the EastEnders song. No, I'm kidding. But do you know what I mean? Like
My personal favourite.
There were songs like Baby Talk and Hypocrite and all of those things pre-Britpop on our records. It's just what, I mean, Emma always said, had it been at a different time, Single Girl would have still been written. It just would have been a B-side. Right. You know? Okay. But yeah, because it was Britpop, everyone's like, well, that has to be the single. And you go, okay, fine.
Yeah, so by 1994, the second album, Split, is being made. So you go to Rockfield to make this?
Yes. We went to a residential studio. Again, Howard's idea, not ours. But, you know, we were quite suggestible in that we would, you know, if someone sort of argued their case, oh, it will be really good, you know, you can concentrate on writing, it will be good for the music, you know, Spooky suffered because blah, 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 let's try it this way. Okay, fine, let's do it that way. So we went to Rockfield. Yeah, I mean, it was fine, but it wasn't particularly conducive, I would say. I think it would have been better if we could have recorded in a place where we could have gone home in the evening and stuff, because for a start, we're not a jamming band. We never were, right? That is not how the songs were written. So there is no need to have all of us there at the same time. Nothing is going to happen. All that happens is Chrissy's recording the drums and me and Emma are going off to ride horses, right? And Phil's just filming Super 8 footage of the countryside. And then it's Phil's turn and the rest of us are fucking doing a jigsaw or something. You know what I mean? And so actually there's quite a lot of downtime for each individual member, and it's quite boring. And once the boys got their stuff done, they could fuck off because me and Emma were doing the vocals and the guitars, and obviously we were the songwriters, so we were more involved with how the production of it went. And then we had to go and mix it, and Mike Hedges wanted us to go to bloody, you know, his place in France to do it. By then I'd been fucking away from home for so long.
So it was quite a difficult process because the original producer, Mike Hedges, it doesn't quite work with him. And you end up getting Alan Moder to finish it?
Yeah, Alan had to kind of come to the rescue and he remixed it. And it took a very long time to make that record. And then when it came out, it slightly bombed, you know, and it wasn't the zeitgeist.
Ivo Watts Russell leaves 4AD. Does that change things?
Yeah. I mean, it was very difficult because that was while we were recording Split. You know, Ivo, well, he didn't leave 4AD then. He was sort of moving to LA. Yeah. They were opening an LA branch. You know, Howard was setting up his own label, which he, you know, ended up signing Menswear to.
Yeah.
You know, everyone was off doing their own thing. Tim Carr, who was our kind of rep at Warner's, was kind of, I don't know, he was eventually leaving as well. So a lot of the people that we relied on, who were our main kind of anchors at all of these, you know, key areas, were kind of vanishing. And I understand that, you know, they had their own shit that they wanted to get on with, but it left us a bit unmoored and a bit abandoned, if I'm honest.
Third and final Lush album, Love Life, comes out in March of 96, made at Protocol Studios off the Holloway Road. I'm sure Simon will make a stick a pin in, probably on Joe Meek's place.
I've looked it up, yeah. It's right next to where the new Arsenal Stadium is.
Lovely, so you're going to like that. But this time you choose the producer. And it's your live engineer, Pete Bartlett, yeah?
Yeah.
What do you remember of that recording and that time?
I mean, for a start, I think that the decision to use Pete was, I do remember Emma sort of talking about this in interviews, and she was saying, you know, we'd kind of work with Robin, we'd work with Tim Friesgrin. There were all these people who kind of, You know, we all enjoyed working with them, but they were people who kind of had their own sound and their own way of working that was sort of imposed on us, not unwillingly, but, you know, that was more the vibe. And Mike Hedges as well, you know, and also that record was, it was just very dispiriting at the end. It's still my favourite record,
yeah,
but it really fucking took it out of us. And I think that it was, you know, using Pete was like, we'd toured so much by then that having been like the worst band in London, inverted commas, we were actually really competent live and we were good. And Pete knew our sound better than anybody else. It just seemed to make sense. Yeah. And to be honest, part of the pressure of, you know, that I do kind of bristle at the idea that we kind of hitched our wagon to fucking Britpop as though that's what we were trying to be. It was, you know, the bit that we kind of like borrowed from Britpop was to go, okay, we will emphasize more the poppy element of our songwriting. You know, there isn't going to be a kind of Desire Lines type long, you know, sonic swathe track. It is going to be more about, you know, simple production, not layers and layers and layers of, you know, affected guitars and stuff. So it's going to be more direct, is what I'm taking a very long time to say.
And Jarvis duet on Chow. So where's Jarvis? I mean, obviously he's now a national treasure, much loved. I can't remember the trajectory. Had they done the Glastonbury thing? Was he the peak Jarvis here, so, or was no, he still your
is,
mate?
The problem is, right, is when I wrote that song, Chris had been hassling me, going like, oh, can I sing the song? I mean, I now wonder whether, or I did wonder afterwards, was he just taking the piss? Because I fucking delivered that. And yeah. I said, there you go. And then he bottled it. And he was going, oh, no, I don't want to sing it now. So, and I was going out with John Best at the time, who was PR, you know, kind of at Savage and Best.
Yeah.
And he was doing Pulp and blah, blah, blah. So he said, oh, well, if, you know, he doesn't want to do it. He said, I could suggest some people. And then he said, well, why don't you just ask Jarvis? Now, this is pre Glastonbury.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's well before then, okay? And there was a time when, you know, I used to go and see Pulp and they were like, you know, I was the one who introduced them to John Best. John Best is the one who got them onto Island, you know? So it actually was like, it was almost like I was the person, you know, they were supporting us.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of championed them. Yeah. So, you know, me asking Jarvis wasn't, you know, it was just kind of, yeah, he was like, he thought it'd be a fun thing to do. And I sent him the demo. And he was like, yeah, yeah, I'll do it. And I was like, oh, brilliant, you know. Well, then subsequently, right, they became fucking massive. And, I mean, bless him, Jarvis, you know, stuck by it and did it. But I'm not sure that the rest of the band were very happy. I had a lot of kind of, you know, the other members go, yeah, but you can't release it as a single. And it's like, all right, fucking cool your boots. Don't worry about it. And I, do you know what I mean? And I did feel a bit like they, you know, that they were thinking like, oh, you're trying to use our success to kind of, you know, you're a bit past it now and you know, a bit sad and now you're trying to coattail on our success, which it, I'm not going to lie, fucking really pissed me off. But you know, that wasn't the case at all. And to be honest, I had to fight to get that fucking song on the album because Ivo fucking hates it, right? To this day, he'll go, I cannot believe that that song is on a record that was on my label. I've been so happy since I walked away. I never thought that I could feel as great as I do today. Cause you were nothing but a big mistake. And life is wonderful now that I'm rid of you. Oh, I must have been. Before the album comes out, the original manager Howard leaves and goes on to sign Menswear. How did it pan out? I'm trying to be sort of level about this because at the time there was a lot of emotion and kind of furore around this. Because to be fair, I think that, you know, Howard was setting up Laurel Records. You know, I just felt he was totally out of control and he didn't really give a shit about Lush anymore. And I think he became a bit of a burden. And actually, you know, I cover it in the book, but we kind of basically decided we'd sack him and then, you know, kind of had a meeting and he turned up. I mean, he obviously knew what was going to happen. So he he resigned first. And he was always one of those people, no, 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 you didn't sack me, I resigned. You know, it was one of those things. And ultimately, I don't really give a shit. The point is that the relationship was over. I mean, I think Chris was very sad about it because he had a real fondness for Howard. But I just thought he was completely unmanageable himself by then. And then it was quite difficult because, you know, we had to try and get another manager. And it was just, yeah, it was hard work. It was hard work. It was a bit like when we auditioned singers, we met like various managers and it was like, fuck me, this is just not going to happen. And then we eventually met Peter Felsted, who we met through the Boo Radleys. He was managing them.
So obviously Lady Killers and Single Girl both land just outside the top 20. The album breaks the top 10 again. There's a lavish video shot in LA and you even get on Top of the Pops and quite a lot of other TV. But instead of capitalising on that, you get sent off to America to tour with the Gin Blossoms.
So I think what's quite interesting is that because we, you know, I think Lush had quite an odd career in that there were times when, you know, we did well in Britain. There were times when we did well in America. And, you know, like Split did fucking nothing in Britain, but it actually did reasonably well. It didn't do brilliantly, but it did reasonably well in America. And in many ways, that was good because it meant that the band always had somewhere where we could kind of get some sort of traction. And it, you know, it wasn't like, I mean, had we just been relying on Britain, Split would have been a complete disaster because we actually toured for the single at the beginning. And then we were meant to go off and do some touring and then tour for the album, and the album tour never happened. So we literally played 8 gigs for the whole of Split. We weren't very happy about that at all. And I think the thing was that with Lady Killers and the kind of Love Life album, you know, Britpop was a kind of British thing, you know, and I've sort of said that, you know, we didn't kind of go out there to make a Britpop album, but that sound,
it fits better with the time.
It was kind of lumped into that stuff. And, you know, actually a lot of the people, the American fans, what they liked was that layered sound and the kind of very washy element, none of which was there really on Love Life. And so it didn't do very well there, you know, and actually most of Britpop didn't do well in America.
A lot of those bands are pretty unknown in America on some levels.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest, a lot of that kind of feeding frenzy.
Even Blur and Pulp are not well known in America, are they?
No, it wasn't the massive thing they thought that it was going to be. And a lot of the kind of feeding frenzy around those Britpop bands in Britain was not just to get them in the British charts. All of these people were banking on the idea that this was going to be like, you know, the Beatles invading America, that that's what was going to happen with Britpop. Like, it's massive in Britain, it's going to be huge in America. Well, that never happened.
Yeah, no.
And so with Love Life, you know, we had like Peter Felsted managing us. And the thing is that being big in America is where the money is, right? And especially for management and those sort of people, that's what they're after, really. And I personally agree with Emma on this because she was very down on Peter and his management of the band. But, you know, he was quite dazzled by America, as Howard had
been. Did she want to concentrate on the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where the band sort of really started to fall apart, where she was like, why are we going back to America again and again and again? And then we did like kind of American festivals in the summer. We did all these radio festivals, which were a kind of treadmill. And, you know, and we could have been playing festivals in Britain. You know, we could have been playing festivals in Europe. We did do some, but not many. We weren't really capitalising. And also, you know, 4AD by then, Ivo was in America. That's where he was. They weren't really driving us to, you know, that it was that corporate interest that was in America. And, you know, we just went along with it because we trusted. I mean, we were always hard workers. We were quite, you know, willing to put the work in. But I think to Emma, it was making less and less sense. And also we were slightly burning out. You know, I think Chris was having problems that we could sort of see, but not with any great clarity. Like, you know, you just sort of think, oh, well, oh, you know, they're a bit knackered, or their personal life is a little bit difficult, or do you know what I mean? It'll be fine. They'll get through it. So there were all sorts of kind of conspiring issues. And also, you know, that's what it does happen to bands. They kind of burn out. You've spent so long in each other's company. Yeah.
You just don't want to talk to each other anymore after a while sometimes.
Well, and, you know, we were all kind of on the brink of turning 30, you know, like all this stuff changes. And
do you think the disparity in public attention between, obviously, what I remember is that yourself and Emma got most of the attention. Do you think that played in the dynamic of the band, or?
I think what's tricky is that, you know, if I think about it, I think we came from a scene where it just wasn't that major label thing. But that's why we signed to 4AD. You know, there was a point when we'd signed, before we actually signed a long-term deal with 4AD and Howard started managing us, he started looking at major labels and was trying to sort of get us to look at, maybe you might want to sign to a major label, because clearly that's where we would get more money. You know, the whole band, you know, but specifically me and Emma, were like, absolutely no way, because we knew what would happen if we went to a major label. That is what they would do. They would put me and Emma front and center. And we came from a world of, like, you know, going to see indie bands and into, you know, bands like New Order and like you say, the Bunny Men and whoever, do you know what I mean? Where they were a band. You didn't really have, I know the Teardrop Explodes was all kind of Julian Cope or whatever, but that wasn't the way that we looked at those bands. All of those, when we were teenagers, yeah, and we were into those bands, we knew the name of the drummer, the bass player, the blah, blah, blah. It was a band. And we didn't want to be marketed in that way. And I think the problem is that it doesn't matter how strongly you feel about that. It's the environment you're in. The Enemy and the Melody Maker were perfectly happy to put, you know, feature whole bands in the 80s, right? But as you go into the 90s, it's getting more tabloid. It's that media is getting more mainstream. And suddenly you have got, you know, just the singer on the cover. It's, you know, Courtney Love on the cover. It's Kurt Cobain. It's, you know, the star, do you know what I mean? And yeah, especially with women, it's even worse. At least you'd have Morrissey or Mara on the cover. But increasingly it became lead singer, lead singer, lead singer, especially if they've got red hair and they're a fucking woman. And I think that...
there wasn't that many women on that scene, really. There was some, but...
I mean, look, I think we made every attempt we could. You know, when we would go on press tours in Europe to do interviews, of course they all just wanted to talk to either just me or me and Emma. We deliberately split ourselves into boy girl, and it's like, well, this is what you're getting. You're going to get me and Chris, or you're going to get Emma and Steve, right? Yeah. And what have you. Not least because Steve and Chris and later Phil are just as interesting. In fact, you know, if you want the best interview, interview Chris. He's actually the funniest member of the band, right? That's where you'll get your great headlines and all of that. So it seems a shame to overlook him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's funny.
So
how
we
that...
did our best to kind of engineer it so that we were covered as a band, you know. And if you look at most of our press, I think we were quite successful with that. You know, I've got books and books and books of press clippings, and every band, you know, member gets to talk. But once you get into that Britpop era, where you're not really dealing with mediums that are about music. It's television, right? It's magazines that have never really written about indie music, but now that it's Britpop, they're writing about it. And these people only want the fucking singer, right? Or they only want the two birds, right? And it's very difficult to go, we're a band, because then they'll just go, well, then we won't have you. And then you've got a record company and a manager going, stop being so ridiculous, we need this coverage. So blah, 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 you know what I mean? Yeah.
So you have to play that game to a degree. But in contrast to the previous record, there's, you know, a 33-date UK tour, quite a lot of US dates. I think you end up making 33 songs for this record, because you've got all the B-sides and all the other remixes, acoustic versions, etc. But in there is a Vashti Bunyan cover. How did you find her?
So Phil bought that single in. Like whenever we pick covers, I mean, I really love doing cover versions. And we had a certain kind of technique to it. You know, we did pick songs that were not obvious for Lush to cover, or they were very, they weren't very well known.
Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep's well known.
Yeah, but that was for an album that was, you had to pick a number one.
Right, okay. Right, yeah.
So it was a compilation. It was a anti-Poltex.
You're a lot more
thing.
Limited if it's only number one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we did consider Yes, Sir, I Can Boogie, but we went with Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep. And I think, so, sorry, where was I? Oh, yeah, cover versions. So, you know, we did that, like, Zounds cover of Demystification. We did, like, you know, Love at First Sight by The Gist. These are not hit songs, and they were fun to cover. And with a cover that's not that well known, you can reinterpret it your own way. And it actually is quite nice to even promote the what you might think of as quite an overlooked artist, you know, and cover one of their songs. So anyway, you know, it's all a bit feel good. And basically, Phil came in with this single. I can't remember why it didn't have any details on it. It just had Vashti on it. That's all it said. It didn't even have her second name. There was no contact label. So I don't know if it was some weird pressing that he got. But 4AD were really trying, you know, everyone was trying to track down who this artist was, and no one got anywhere. So we covered it, and it was just on there as Vashti. And then when I met Vashti Bunyan, she actually said that she'd kind of left music for decades. And she said it was when she got a personal computer, and she said I did the classic thing where you Google yourself, and then it came up that there'd been this cover version. So she got in touch with 4AD, and it was this sort of like, oh my God, we've been looking everywhere for you. And she said, oh, I got my first kind of publishing check for like two decades, you know, which was quite sweet.
I'd like to walk around in your mind someday. I'd like to walk all over the things you say to me.
In September of 1996, what turns out to be the final gig takes place in Japan. And not long after, Emma calls a band meeting. So what happens at this meeting?
So I think, you know, with the way that the American touring and the kind of relentlessness of it, Emma had definitely had enough. And so, I mean, I kind of knew what was coming in this meeting because, well, there'd been some crap before it. But anyway, we had this meeting, and she said, look, you know, we've got a European tour and we've got this, so I'll do all that. But, you know, my memory of this meeting was, I just remember her going, look, I just don't want to write another Love Life. I don't want to write a hit record. I don't want to, you know, write songs that if they don't get in the charts, it's a bloody disaster. I just don't want that. And I was like, well, I agree, actually. We are actually agreeing on all of this. So I think the meeting ended, for me, the meeting ended with a kind of like, look, I said, I don't actually care. If you want to write an album's worth of Gregorian chants, I'm all for it, right? But I think it's a real shame to break this band up when it's not really, you know, we're agreeing on the music, right? This is really about external pressures. This is about management, and it's about how the label is going and how the music industry is going. It's not really about the band and the music it makes. So I think we should try and make another record. So that's where I left it, you know. I mean, in hindsight, I would actually argue that the music industry was changing so much that actually Ride split up not long after, My Bloody Valentine disappeared not long after, Slow Dive did, all of these bands.
Yeah, within a year or two of that time, yeah, a lot of those bands are gone, aren't they?
Because I just think that industry had changed, and people would just get dropped if you didn't get in the charts. So chances are we would have made an album, you know, 4AD, which no longer even had like Ivo involved in it, would have probably gone like, do you know what? There's no point in us releasing this because it's just not going to do anything. They may have even said that at the demo stage, and we probably would have been dropped. That's my guess, right? Yeah. Just because I think it's so much to do with how that industry was going. But, you know, that decision was never really had to be made because, you know, I mean, less than a month later, Chris died.
The breakup wasn't actually announced for about over a year after that. So in early 1998.
Yeah, that's my fault, really. I mean, it is my fault. I was so angry. Like, I mean, I was obviously completely devastated by Chris's death, but I was very angry with how the press reported it. And look, you know, times have changed now. I don't think people talk about suicide in the same way. You know, this very asinine kind of trying to explain and you know, lay some sort of blame for it. That is not how it works. You know, and Emma was going, look, I think we should announce that, you know, the band split up. And I
so
was
she's
just like...
She's got a new band by that point.
Well, at some point, it was before she'd really got that band going, but she was like, look, I really... Well, basically, she probably was planning. She knew that she was going to be having a new band, so maybe that was another reason why she wanted that door closed. But my thing was like, no, fuck them. I don't... No, fuck them. They can fucking wait forever. I don't give a shit. You know, I'm not even going to engage with this process. And then I think eventually she said, look, I just don't think it's really fair on the fans.
So how did the reunion gigs of 2016, what led you to want to do that?
Oh, I mean, you know, I think that when Lush ended, it was very difficult because it was like, you know, what the fuck do I do now? You know what I mean? Like, I had everything invested in that band. And I had to kind of, yeah, you know, find a job and, you know, I had children. I built a new life and I was very happy with that new life, actually. You know, it was quite a relief to not, you know, to have a 9-to-5 job where you don't have to give a fuck. You're not lying awake worrying about what crazy shit Howard is going to do tomorrow or, you know, whether you're going to, you know, get this tour or not, or whether, you know, whatever fucking factional band problems are going on, you know. So it's actually quite a relief to go in, you know, and fuck me, you get paid well. Jesus Christ, I earned more being a fucking sub on a TV listings magazine than I earned out of the fucking band, you know, at the time. So I was very happy with my life. But I think, you know, Emma had been in Sing Sing, and then a lot of the jobs she did subsequently were involved with music. You know, she was working for a booking agent, I think.
So she'd stayed in the music world.
Yeah. And Phil as well, you know, he was playing in bands. He'd joined the Mary Chain, so he was still in that world. I'd completely cut off from that world, absolutely and entirely. I barely went to any gigs, you know, not least because every time I went, it was just too painful. I think I became a bit phobic about it because I would just start thinking of Chris and get really miserable. And no one wants someone really miserable at a gig. So, you know, I just thought, well, I'll just, you know, vacate the space, really. So really it came from Emma and Phil. And I wasn't on social media because I thought, well, why should I be? You know, I think I'd even had emails at IPC. Every now and again, I'd get an email from someone who'd track me down. And sometimes it was really nice. They'd go, oh, hey, God, I can't believe it was that easy to find out where you are. And they do a kind of, you know, it was really, I loved your music kind of thing. It's very nice. But occasionally I get someone who was a bit fucking persistent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wasn't on social media. I got asked occasionally. There was one or two incidences. I think Nevermind the Buzzcocks asked if me and Emma would go on as, you know, one of those picked out of a lineup,
yeah,
you know, which
those.
One of those people. And I think, I mean, my memory is that Emma kind of would have done it because fair enough, she had a band to promote. And I was like, why on earth would I fucking do that? It's humiliating. Why the fuck would I do that? It's insane. Yeah.
Have one every week.
And I get it. If you've got something to promote, you
might
think,
well, some of them didn't though.
Well, yeah, and fine, do it if you want to. But I mean, I kind of just genuinely, I mean, I'm not being funny. When I worked at IPC, I don't think I told anyone I'd been in a band until
right,
for about
yeah.
5 years.
Yeah.
Right, a couple of people sussed it out. But I just didn't talk about it because, you know, it wasn't an embargo. If someone asked me, I go, oh, yeah, you know. But it was just another life, really. Because they were online, Emma and Phil, because they were, you know, into, you know, kind of involved in that music world, they could see that that certain bands had reformed. They could see that Slow Dive were back on the road and blah, blah, blah. And also they could see that, you know, there was quite a lot of, as Emma put it, there's quite a lot of love out there for the kind of shoegaze stuff. Yeah. I think that really surprised me. And I think it got suggested, there was a previous time before that actual reunion, there was a previous incident of potentially doing All Tomorrow's Parties and maybe reforming just to do that and doing Spooky. And I think Emma and Phil were quite keen on it. But, you know, my kids were small. I had another life. I was very reluctant, if I'm honest, very reluctant, because to me, I was very, very bruised by the end of Lush on many levels. You know, I noted that there was all sorts of, you know, articles that would come out going on about, you know, 90s music. We were consistently left out of any narrative, you know, all ridiculed, you know. And I just thought, why would I want to go back to that? You know, it's like back in the firing line, you know. So I didn't want to do it. And even when they came back to me in like the tour took place in 2016, but obviously it kind of was being mooted a couple of years before that. You know, Emma had found this guy who was a manager who was very enthusiastic about making it happen. I don't know, there was a lot of people making noises, but it still took me about 8 months to make my mind up, right? You know,
so it was quite a long process, but there were obviously two nights at the Roundhouse followed by a full tour, loads of festivals, etc. But you decide that you don't want it to be a cash-in, so you do actually make some new material.
You know, that was quite difficult because I did think, not only on a personal level. Okay, so here are the things, right? The idea of doing a Lush tour without Chris, I found very, very difficult. You know, I just thought it would be emotionally very hard. I thought that, okay, I'll accept that now Lush seemed to be on the radar of, interestingly, a lot of young bands who seem to be reviving this idea of shoegaze. By reforming, right, and everybody always thinks you're just doing it to cash in, are we shitting on the legacy of everything we've done? You know, also, how equipped am I? I haven't been on a fucking stage in 20 years and I've got to go up there and front the band and play all these songs again. That's really daunting. So there was a multitude of reasons why I wasn't very keen. And I remember going to America to visit my mum, and Clint Mansell, who, you know, was in Pop Elite itself and became like a kind of, you know, producer of music for film and stuff, very successful, you know, all of that. Well, he remained a friend. So every time I'd go out there, I'd always see him. And he actually said to me, because I was talking to him about the potential reunion, and I just remember him sort of going like, if you're going to do it, don't do it for the money. There has to be another reason, because if you only do it for the money, it will be a disaster, I promise you, right?
Yeah.
So that's why I had to think long and hard about it. And eventually, you know, because we were going to make another record, and because I did think, well, I guess there is this whole past that my kids don't know about, my friends don't really know about, a lot of the friends that I've made, you know, since I've had children and blah, blah, blah. And also I just thought, well, it's almost my last chance. Like, maybe it would be a good life experience, you know, last throw of the dice, fuck it. You know, I mean, it was never going to be a long-term thing. It was always a kind of, right, I'm going to actually take time off work and I've got a sabbatical coming up. So, I mean, there were bits where I'd go on tour and then I'd be back at work on Monday, you know, and back doing TV listings, right? Or no, by then I was at Web User, so I was doing my techie.
Yeah, I mean, presumably there's a lot of time.
Yeah, but, you know, part of my thing was I need to be able to go back to this job when this is over.
Yes.
So this is, there's a...
You don't want to burn that bridge necessarily.
I can't. I can't afford to. Because whatever this fucking manager is promising, oh, you're going to make $100,000 each or whatever. I thought, yeah, I've fucking heard that before. That's bollocks. I was like, no, you know, this is how it's going to be. So anyway, the point is that, you know, I think... I was quite excited in the end, not least because actually, you know, getting Justin in was great. He's a really lovely bloke and he had real enthusiasm for it. And, you know, even just rehearsing, I remember sort of standing in rehearsal.
So Justin Welsh comes in on drums to replace Chris.
Yeah. And, you know,
which is nice because they were friends originally.
They were very good friends. So there was a kind of nice side to that. And you know, and actually rehearsing was really good fun. I'd forgotten how much fun it was to actually just play music all day and get into it. And, you know, I don't know, seeing Pete Bartlett again, who was doing our sound, blah, blah, blah. You know, it was really good fun. And, you know, me and Emma were getting on great. And it was nice to be back in that kind of camaraderie of being in a band. So I was really enjoying it. And then making the record, it was really exciting. And you know, I had to write lyrics for the song. So that was kind of, yeah, it was nice to kind of dust off all those old muscle memory and get back in the saddle, really. Yeah. And it was a great opportunity.
And it was a very successful reunion tour.
Yeah, it did well.
Yeah, so the last gig of that reunion tour took place at the Manchester Academy. And then since then, you've continued to make music.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is that by the end of that tour, you know, there was a big bust up, you know, me and Phil, or rather it was Emma and Phil are still mates, you know, it was me. And so, you know, we're no longer talking and it all got a bit ugly and what have you. And Phil didn't do the last gig. So the last gig, actually, Mick Conroy from Modern English played the bass for that gig. And, you know, actually, because most of the rehearsing for that was me and Mick and Justin together to get Mick up to speed to be able to play the gig, that's kind of where Peroshka was, that was born out of.
Right, okay.
Because so Justin was very that. Kind of like, well, you've got to do, now that you're back, you've got to do more music. And I was like, no. But then we did have a really good laugh, like rehearsing together. And then it was like, all right, fuck it, let's have a go then, because they were both into it. And then Moose is sitting right there in my kitchen. And I said, okay, well, it would be crazy if you didn't just fucking join. You know, because for all the years that we were together, people were always like, why don't you and Moose make music together? And it's like, I'm not really the person, as I said, I'm not very good at planning and launching things. They have to kind of happen around me accidentally. And so that's exactly what happened with Peroshka. It just happened because we were rehearsing for that last lush gig, and then it just grew out of that. Peroshka did two albums. The last album was kind of, you know, put out just after lockdown. We did do a tour, but that's when I think, you know, during lockdown, I got like offered the book. So I was writing the book and the book was coming out and I knew that that was going to take up a chunk of my time. And, you know, Justin loves being in bands. So he, you know, was like, look, I'm going to form this other band. And it was like, yeah, whatever. In the interim, Mick actually moved to America. He's got married and he's living in America. So Peroshka, I never say never, but, you know, there's a kind of natural sort of disintegration to that band at the moment. And this band, the Mickey Brenny Trio, I often just call it MB3 because I can't actually bear the fact that it's got my name in it. But both Ollie and Moose were like, you have to put your name in it. Do you know what I mean?
Nobody should tour with My Buddy Valentine.
I know.
MBV and MB3.
Yes. Well, we can call it a nod to that then, can't we?
That's a marketer's dream, having that, surely.
But even this band was really born out of just doing the book and being asked to do kind of music to support the book. And, you know, because I don't do these things on my own, I had to, you know, so we had this little band doing a few lush songs, but again, because we were really enjoying our time together, it was like, well, maybe we should make a record as well, you know. So that's kind of born out of that as well. So now that's got kind of legs. And although, I mean, it's a bit weird because we're playing gigs now before we've got an album. And we're writing the songs as we go along. And so, you know, it started with us just doing Lush and Peroshka songs. So we're slightly sort of weeding the Lush and Poroshka songs out of the set as we write new songs, you know.
Brilliant. Well, there we go. So it's a fantastic book. We recommend it to anyone that's listening that hasn't read it yet. Obviously, you can find out about Lush along with everything else in there. Right, Mickey, true or false? Jive Records, which originated in Willesden, was then bought out and moved to New York and became a huge American record label. Only one of these three songs was a US number one.
Well, you know what I think about charts, but go on, yeah.
They were all number one in the UK. Only one of these songs was number one in the US. Britney Spears, Hit Me Baby One More Time. R. Kelly, I Believe I Can Fly. Or DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Boom Shake the Room.
I'm going to say Boom Shake the Room.
The correct answer is Britney Spears, Hit Me Baby One More Time.
Which is the obvious one. And yeah. I thought, no, it's going to be the not obvious one.
But to me, they're all songs that I would have thought would be have been a number one. Because they're all really famous songs.
They all were number one in the UK.
One more. Morgan Studios, which was located in Willesden. It was then split into Battery Studios and Power Plant Studios later. Battery's still there to this day. Was the first studio in the world to use 8-track recording. True or not, Mark?
Well, I don't know, obviously. And I'm tempted to say this is a falsehood as well. And I don't know why, because I'm thinking of, I don't know why I'm thinking of Les Paul, the inventor of the guitarist who invented multi-track recording. But I'm going to say no, just to give you the gleeful response that, Mark, you're wrong. Go on.
It was the first studio to use 24-track recording, so 8 is false. But if I just mention some of the people who've made records at this studio in Willesden... Led Zeppelin, Blind Faith, Paul Simon, Paul McCartney, Supertramp, Jethro Tull, Free, Donovan, Rod Stewart, Elton John, Lou Reed made Berlin there, Black Sabbath, The Jam made News of the World in Willesden, Motorhead, Thin Lizzy, and The Cure made 17 Seconds and Faith, and also the singles Charlotte Sometimes and A Forest, all made in Willesden Green.
That's incredible. I didn't actually know that. Has it got a plaque?
Well, it's still there as Battery Studios. It's still a studio to this
right,
day.
Give Mickey a take. Give her a plaque to take back, and she can, with some blue tack, and she can do that.